Hello, I'm Keith Powell, and welcome to Media Network Plus from PCJ Radio International. Today we actually have quite a mixed bag of things on the program, so hopefully we don't run out of time. A few weeks ago, the world learned that Trevor Graham Bayliss, CBE, or just Mr. Trevor Bayliss, passed away at age 80 on March 5th of this year. Now, he was an English inventor. He invented actually many different things, from electrical power-generating shoes to jar openers to many things you can actually imagine. But one invention that he will be forever known for is inventing the wind-up radio or the clockwork radio. This was something that he had thought about when the world was getting informed on the AIDS situation in Africa. Now, any of you who have ever been to Africa before, or even if you haven't been to Africa, I can tell you right now, batteries are very expensive. Now, perhaps not in places like South Africa, but if you go to other countries, batteries are expensive. And they're not as good quality ones as maybe the ones you find in the shops, wherever you are. They are really cheaply made Chinese batteries that either leak after a couple of days or only provide 1 or 2 hours of electricity to power a radio. Now, you may be saying to yourself, well, what about using the power grid? Well, that is another problem in itself that Africa, of course, is trying to deal with. So he invented a clockwork radio. Now, you think about it. Actually, it is a very simple idea. I mean, we had clockwork products. Well, throughout history, there were clockwork gramophones, even projectors, toys, and everything else. So why not have a clockwork to run a radio? What we are going to listen to now is a profile that Newsnight on the BBC did about Trevor Bayliss.
This is in the Guinness Book of Records, and it's my electric shoe. You have devices inside there, and when you put your foot down, every time you do that, a little tweak of electricity comes through and is injected into your mobile phone battery, which is in the side pack. My name is Trevor Bayliss, and I call myself an inventor. This workshop is where it all began. This is the graveyard of 1,000 domestic appliances, if you understand me. I'm known, I guess, for making the clockwork radio. That's how I wound it up. Be interesting to see if it still works. Yeah, I was watching a program about the spread of HIV/AIDS in Africa, and they said the only way they could stop this dreadful disease cutting its way through all those places was through radio, a means of communication, but there was a problem. Most people in Africa didn't have electricity. And the only other form of electricity was in the form of batteries, which were horrendously expensive. I'm then thinking to myself, hang on, all those years ago, I can see myself with an old-fashioned gramophone. And I thought, you know, you wind this thing up, and you can get all that noise by dragging a rusty nail around a piece of old Bakelite, as it were, and that produces that volume of sound. So there must be enough energy in that spring to drive a small dynamo, which in turn would drive a radio. I've only got one arm, okay? Here's your bottle. That goes there. Now you can undo the top. Okay? I'll tighten it up. Then it undoes it for you. Here we are. Everybody's doing their own version of a wind-up torch radio and so on and so forth. What they do is circumnavigate your invention. Like, the handle turns this way, right? They make it so it goes the other way. It's different to yours. You know, they can play very dodgy maneuvers in order to claim it to be theirs. Because, you know, theirs is subtly different. Now, if I put that on there and I point that towards the camera, wherever I take my chariot, the sign looks at you. And that's Meccano. We're not talking about high-tech, we're talking low-tech. You've only got to look back through time. The United Kingdom, or the empire that was, the golden age of steam. Steam engines, locomotives, they went all around the world. There are so many other things that we have created and done over the years. We are great at inventing, but alas, alas now, the people that are supposed to run our innovation units or, look after the inventors, treat me, amongst other people, like dirt. In other words, don't invent. Most of us don't have all the skills we need to bring a product to market. You've got to appreciate that some people have the most amazing ability to change all our lives socially and commercially. For instance, we've all got paper clips, right? How many of us actually know who made the paper clip? And yet these people that change all our lives, we don't even know who they are, which is disgusting, really, because we've got to encourage this nation to literally get off its backside and have a go. And we have to make sure that UK PLC will stand behind the lone inventor. And I have no problem with products being made in China, Timbuktu, India, right? They'll make a profit, fine. But the most important thing is the British economy doesn't suffer as a result of it, and that the inventor, he or she, are not kicked out of the equation. Now, if we do it that way, and we make the theft of intellectual property a white-collar crime, it could be an everybody-wins situation. We've got to try and get the patent system to be a universal thing. We don't want to go to a country and they say, "Oh, sorry, mate, we don't do it this way." Because there's no point in having a patent office if it's not a universal system.
The late Trevor Bell was speaking a few years ago about, his Clockwork Radio and many other things. Sadly, Trevor Bayliss was a brilliant man. He was a brilliant inventor. But history has shown us there have been great inventors out there who were just very bad at business. Even Thomas Edison, who was hailed as creating the light bulb and electric batteries and even had an electric car, one of the first to invent electric motors, was also not a very good businessman. Brilliant minds. So hopefully any inventors out there can maybe change that for the future. Now, let's talk about mobile phones for a moment. There are a number of mobile phones on the market. Two of the major players, of course, are Apple and their iPhone and Samsung with its Galaxy series. Now, these would be considered perhaps by many as being the two high-end phones that are on the market. There are a lot of other brands as well. Kind of mid to high-term range would be a company like HTC, which is based here in Taiwan. And then, of course, a lot of Chinese-made mobile phones. Companies, for example, like Xiaomi, which has made inroads in some Pacific countries and developing countries because they are extremely affordable. But one thing about a lot of the low-end and lower-cost mobile smartphones is it's true what they say. You really do get what you pay for. Now, one of the big players in this sector of the mobile community is a company called Huawei. Now, Huawei is one of the largest Chinese mobile phone providers. They don't just do mobile phones, but also networks as well, building up internet networks and mobile phone networks. But the company itself has, well, a little bit of a, how shall I put it, it has a bit of a past that can raise some eyebrows. The owner of the company, the founder of the company, was a member of the People's Liberation Army and has had connections with China's security service. Now, this has raised a lot of eyebrows in many countries. This week, APRA issued a warning to Australia's financial institutions saying a cyber attack is probably inevitable. The Australian Prudential Regulatory Authority has called on banks, insurance companies, and superannuation funds to improve their cybersecurity policies. It comes just days after the U.S. Director of National Intelligence, Dan Coats, also issued a similar warning. And As both Australia and the United States face increasing cybersecurity threats, there are calls for the two nations to cooperate on cybersecurity in the Indo-Pacific region. Now, this actually has to do with companies like Huawei. In some countries, if you do work for the government, they forbid you to use a Huawei phone. This is mainly because Huawei's servers are in China. And you could be in another country, but all that information actually goes back to China, which then, of course, hackers would be able to access and then break into other networks. So this is the, you could say, the ground that they are on. Chris Palmer is the former U.S. State Department Coordinator for Cyber Issues and White House Senior Director for Cybersecurity Policy. We're now going to take a listen to an interview that he did for RN Breakfast on the ABC.
You've been in the cybersecurity field for decades now. What cybersecurity threats do you see for us in our region?
Well, I think many of the same that we see in our region. There are a number of different threat actors. As Director Code said, there are very sophisticated nation states, including Russia, China, Iran, and North Korea. Certainly in this region, you have a couple of those. But because cyber is global and it's not just regional, you really could be the target of any of those nation states. And then you have transnational organized criminal groups who are after money rather than disruption or stealing secrets. And then you have the lone gunman hackers, and you have others out there. And also there are terrorists, although the terrorists have used the internet more to plan and communicate and raise money rather than trying to cause disruptive attacks so far. But we don't know what the future holds.
And what are the strategic aims of these nation states in hacking?
Well, it very much depends. I mean, certainly we had a big issue just a couple of years ago, as did you, with the widespread theft of trade secrets and intellectual property by China, and both you and we reached an agreement with them that that was something that shouldn't be permitted, and we're monitoring that very closely. Russia, certainly one thing we were not prepared for in the U.S. was the Russian interference in our election. We were worried about attacks on infrastructure, certainly. We were worried about theft of information. That was really a new hybrid threat we hadn't really thought of before, and it's certainly a key issue. And then just last week, there was a attribution of a big cyber attack called NotPetya, which it really disrupted shipping lanes around the world. Maersk caused tens of millions of dollars of damage. Australia, the U.S., and other countries said that that was the Russian state. There was another one that was attributed to North Korea. So some of these can be disruptive attacks, just trying to disrupt our infrastructure. Others can be just simply stealing our information.
And so who and what is most vulnerable in your view? Because we have, you know, institutions that might be vulnerable. We have key infrastructure that might be vulnerable. But then we have individual organizations and us as individuals as well. Where do you see the greatest threat lying?
Well, unfortunately, all of us are vulnerable, and as we become more dependent on these technologies. When I started prosecuting these cases 25 years ago, you know, the internet was just getting going. People weren't as dependent on it as they are today, and we're becoming ever more dependent on it. Not just for communications and our finances, and companies being dependent on, governance being dependent on it. But when we have things like the Internet of Things, where everything is getting connected to the internet, we're getting even more dependent on it. So certainly governments are vulnerable, and they are a target of attack. Businesses, too, often for their you know, trade secrets, but also to hold them hostage for money. Individuals are targeted. You know, it's almost a risk management thing. You have to figure out what are your most valuable things and how do you protect them.
You've said that you'd like to see Australia and the US cooperate more in this field. I note that the US government has said it's concerned about the threat of the Chinese company Huawei. They're working to become a world leader in 5G technology and to play a crucial role in building out our capacity in that area. Why should we be concerned about engaging a company like that, which is not said to be part of the Chinese government, although we have a pretty nuanced understanding of the relationship between corporations and the Chinese government. Why should we be worried about them?
Well, first I should say that certainly more cooperation is always better, but Australia and the U.S. have been really strong partners for many, many years, and that's just getting stronger. There's been a number of things that Australia has been doing to really bulk up their cybersecurity. On that issue, it's essentially a risk management issue. As you move into 5G, it's not just about communications anymore. It's communications, it's infrastructure, it's the Internet of Things. That creates a huge vulnerability, a huge risk profile. So if you're doing a risk management approach, you look at that then you look at the potential actors that you're using to build your network. And when an actor is in a country where the government has a lot of control or could exercise a lot of control, that creates a risk.
But in terms of Huawei being involved in building our 5G capacity in Australia, from what I've read, the concern is that this might impact our security sharing or intelligence sharing arrangements with the United States.
Well, certainly if you have an actor who could take information, who could do the kind of intelligence operations and take sensitive information off networks, that's a concern.
So if they built the grid or whatever the infrastructure is for the 5G networks in Australia, that you would be concerned that potentially would give the Chinese government access to anything that was communicated over that network.
I think that's a substantial risk, and I think you'd have to look at whether you can mitigate that at all and how you would do that. And if you can't do that,
can you?
I don't know. I'm not the technical person who should look at this. It's a political decision in some sense too, but I would be concerned.
The former Australian intelligence and defence official Dennis Richardson suggested that instead of banning Huawei, we should work with them checking their work. Do you think mitigating, as you say, those risks is a viable option?
Look, I think it's harder with 5G. When you're talking about 4G or other networks, there was a way of saying, look, let's look at the core versus the perimeter of the network. When you're talking about 5G, it's much more spread out. It's much more, there's no real core in some senses. So that makes that mitigation harder to do. Certainly, it's something that can be looked at, but I'm not sure that mitigation actually will work. And, you know, things could change. The geopolitical situation could change very quickly. Does China have an incentive to disrupt Australian networks? There's one thing, taking information, the kind of intelligence operations. There's another, if you want to disrupt the networks and cause really widespread problems. They don't have that incentive right now, but who knows what could happen in the future. Intent can change very quickly.
We talk a lot about bad actors and state actors in these sort of contexts. How active are countries like Australia and America in the offensive game in this realm?
Look, I think every country, over 100 countries are developing offensive cyber capabilities, and probably literally every country really is if they could. That's just a natural evolution of the technology. And we should. We should have that arrow in our quiver, especially when we're responding to these bad state actors who are out there doing things like Russia recently.
But what does that mean? What does it look like? What would we be doing?
Well, I think there's this romanticizing in movie. If you see movies, that there's some cyber button you push and suddenly all these things happen. I think it's a lot more complicated than that. And frankly, I think cyber tools are being developed to help for defensive purposes. However, there's a lot more to be done there. And then when you have those cyber tools, I think you have to have a doctrine around them. You have to have a doctrine of how you use them. One of the things we're worried about internationally is as countries are developing this, we need some rules of the road in place.
Chris Payne said we will have to leave it there. I'd love to keep talking all morning. Former U.S. State Department Coordinator for Cyber Issues and White House Senior Director for Cybersecurity Policy, Chris Painter.
And if you've just tuned in, you're listening to Media Network Plus, coming to you from PCJ Radio International. Now, how many of you know the name Andrew Fisher? No idea. Well, I suppose, of course, if you are Australian, you probably know him. He was Australia's fifth Prime Minister. Now, the Scottish-born Andrew Fisher also started a newspaper to campaign for his former seat when he was a politician. And just over 100 years ago, he did become Australia's fifth Prime Minister. So let's talk about being a Prime Minister who started a newspaper. Richard Ady speaks next to Jolyn Sykes, a freelance journalism researcher at the Journalism Education and Research Association of Australia.
He won that first election and absolutely horrified the Gympie establishment. I don't know if you've ever, I was born in Gympie. Gympie's a very conservative town.
So, in fact, the person he defeated was editor of the paper.
Editor of the Gympie Times,
and
yes.
Came after him.
He absolutely ran a very powerful campaign in ink over the next few years, and he was defeated. So Andy then decided to take a leaf out of this guy's book and started his own paper. He set up a cooperative society in the Scottish tradition and raised enough capital to start his own newspaper.
Which was called The Truth.
The Truth. The Gympie Truth. Yes, that's right. The masthead reads, Truth, Organ of the Common Herd.
Right.
Which I always think is quite funny.
This is sort of unimaginable now that a politician in fact, a defeated politician, so an aspirant politician again, would start a paper in order to be re-elected.
Yes, I've never come across it before, now that you put it like that. Yeah, there are a few cases back in those days where politicians did start newspapers to, in order to retain power.
Can you give me an example?
The one that led Fisher, I think, was James Kirkhardie. In
Scotland.
In Scotland, yeah, who was one of the founders of the British Labour Party, and he set up his own newspaper.
The Miner, I think
the
it
Miner,
was.
Or something like that.
Something like that.
That's right, yeah.
It later changed, I think, to something else. But yeah, he did. So he raised the money, but he didn't edit the paper, did he?
No, he got a bloke called Boot to edit it. I don't know how he advertised or if he did, but he the job interview took place in Gympie, in the railway locomotive workshops. Fisher was oiling an engine or something or other, and they did the job interview. Fisher offered him the job, and Boot accepted and said that he undertook to bring out a brightly written little thing.
Neat looking and brightly written.
That's right, yes.
Of 12 pages. Was this every week?
Yes. Yes,
yeah. And he was paid, I think, the princely sum of £3 a
week. £3, yeah, those were the days.
So how partisan was the Truth?
Well, probably just as partisan as the Gympie Times was. But
so partisan?
Oh, yeah, absolutely, yes. I've read bits of it, and it's not that sort of impartial journalism that you and I perhaps have come to expect.
Do we still have copies of it? Do they still exist?
Yes.
They do?
Oh, yes. Actually, my father could remember when it was still going, so I think it must have run right up into World War II.
And was it only about politics, or did it try and cover things like the community and sport and
gossip,
horse racing and all those things that newspapers would have covered?
Yeah.
Mm. Right. Okay. It's just that when it covered the politics, it covered them from that perspective of trying to get him elected, effectively.
In the beginning, yes, and then it became when Fisher resigned and went as High Commissioner to London, the paper then became much more reformist and anti-establishment, and I think that's probably what ended up doing it in, because Gympie's a very conservative place.
All right, let's go back a bit, though, because he started this paper really to get himself back into Parliament.
Yes.
And it worked.
It worked. Hmm. And he never lost another election in that district, state or federal.
So he was returned in what, 1899?
Yes, that's right. Just in time to take part in the first federal election, 1901.
Right.
He was one of the people that actually took federation seriously. A lot of politicians didn't. They thought it was a passing fad, and it's not really going to make much difference anyway. But he took it seriously and saw it as an opportunity.
And off he went to the federal parliament.
He won, yes, and off he went.
With the support, obviously, of the Truth.
Yes, that's right.
But, of course, once he was elected, and this is true for Queensland, but especially once he was in Melbourne, because that's where the federal parliament was in those days, he would have to interact with lots of other newspapers.
Yes, that's right. Well, he built on his own experience on the Truth, but the Melbourne press was pretty radical in those days, and the Labour side of politics was quite revolutionary and radical and didn't really appeal to the electorate. So Fisher was able to bring a degree of sanity into that sort of revolutionary atmosphere and to get an agenda that working people in Victoria could accept and vote for, and they did.
It's in fact, it's even more complicated, from what I gather, than what you're saying, because there were really kind of two presses. There was the radical press of the left, and then there was the big metropolitan press.
The Age.
And the Argus.
The Age and the Argus,
which were conservative.
Oh, yes, yes.
And he had to be able to deal with both of them.
Yes, well, I think he managed that by simply being very conscientious, very straight, making good contacts.
Not drinking.
He was absolutely abstemious, which I don't know how that would endear itself to journalists, but anyway, it did.
Yes.
So he got this reputation of being, you know, reliable, hardworking, that worked for him.
This is something you would argue he deliberately cultivated. He was aware of his media image even back then.
I think so. I think so. And I think it was a in a way, I mean, it suited him too, but it was also a way of differentiating himself from the rest of the left. I mean, he formed some very good friendships with and I go through a couple of them in this piece.
So do you think it was the experience of owning a paper, in effect, that meant that he had a better understanding of how they worked and how journalists worked and what they were interested in?
Yeah, what was news, what deadlines meant. And, and I think he was always very good on deadlines. His daughter wrote a little bit about him and deadlines in her memoirs, and he took deadlines very, very seriously.
So he's now an obscure figure, ridiculously obscure considering that he was a prime minister. What did he get done that we can thank his sort of media nuanced knowledge for?
Yeah, well, there was the Commonwealth Bank, there was the baby bonus, pensions, the idea of the welfare state safety net was Fisher's idea of socialism, the taxpayer-funded safety net, pensions, baby bonus, all that.
And he had to manage the and it was all the press then, of course. There was no broadcasting. No. He had to manage the positions of various newspapers who may have been less keen on these and find a way of getting them sold.
Yes. And I think his image helped, the steadfast, reliable image.
Abstemious Scott.
Mm, that's right, yeah. I think that really helped in those days.
I'm sure it did. Mm. It's been fascinating, Johnny, and thanks very much for joining me today.
It's a real pleasure being here, Richard.
And with that, we've come to the end of this edition of Media Network Plus from PCJ Radio International. For a second there, I was going to say something else, and it doesn't really matter. I was going to mention a program that I was just recording an hour ago. But anyway, if you want to get in touch with us, we'd love to hear from you. Our email address is mnp@pcjmedia.com. That's mnp@pcjmedia.com. We're going to end today with a blast from the past. What is that going to be? Well, stay around for about a minute and you'll see what it is. So until next time, friends, I'm Keith Powell wishing you well, saying so long, au revoir, auf Wiedersehen, adios amigos, and sayonara.
That is the call sign of Radio RSA, the voice of South Africa, broadcast 10 minutes before the commencement of the transmission proper. The call sign is based on a South African folk song, Fair and Everald Kitty, which in English is translated from the Afrikaans means Far in the Wild World Kitty. The bird you can hear is a bokmakiri.
Media Network Plus has been a production of PCJ Radio International.